Chapter 72. Out of a world all but vanished, her brass steam whistle splitting the air, the seawater frothing white beneath her churning paddle wheels, and spewing black smoke from her towering twin stacks, the Stonewall Jackson pitched toward the towboat with the awkward grace of a pregnant southern belle, hoisting her hooped skirts while crossing a mud puddle. Shrieking gulls rode the wind above a giant stern flag displaying the crossed bars and stripes of the Confederacy, while on the roof of the Texas deck, a man furiously pounded out the Old South's national hymn, Dixie, on the keyboard of an old-fashioned steam calliope. The sight of the old riverboat charging across the sea stirred the souls of the men flying above. They knew they were witnessing an adventure none would see again. In the ornate pilot-house, Pitt and Giordino stared at the barge and towboat that loomed closer with every revolution of the 30-foot paddle-wheels. "The man was right," Giordino shouted above the steam whistle and calliope. "What man?" Pitt asked loudly. "The one who said, 'Save your Confederate money, the South will rise again.'" "Lucky for us it has," Pitt said, smiling. "We're gaining." This from a wiry little man who twisted the 6-foot helm with both hands. "They've lost speed," Pitt concurred. "If the boilers don't blow and the sweet old darling holds together in these damned waves—" The man at the wheel paused in mid-sentence, made an imperceptible turn of his big white bearded head, and let fly a spurt of tobacco juice with deadly accuracy into a brass cuspidor before continuing. "We ought to overtake 'em in the next 2 miles." Captain Melvin Belcheron had skippered the Stonewall Jackson for 30 of his 62 years. He knew every buoy, bend, sandbar, and riverbank light from St. Louis to New Orleans by heart. But this was the first time he'd ever taken his boat into the open sea. The Sweet Old Darlin' was built in 1915 at Columbus, Kentucky, on the Ohio River. Her like was the last to stoke the fires of imagination during the golden years of steamboating, and her like would never be seen again. The smell of burning coal, the swish of the steam engine, and the rhythmic splash of the paddle wheels would soon belong only in the history books. Her shallow wooden hull was long and beamy, measuring 270 feet by 44. Her horizontal non-condensing engines ran at about 40 revolutions per minute. She was rated at slightly over 1,000 tons. Yet, despite her bulk, she walked the water with a draft of just 32 inches. Down below on the main deck, 4 men, sweat-streaked and blackened with soot, furiously shoveled coal into the furnaces under 4 high-pressure boilers. When the pressure began to creep into the red, the chief engineer, a crusty old Scot by the name of McGean, hung his hat over the steam gauge. McGean was the first man to vote for pursuit after Pitt crash-landed the helicopter in shallow water near Fort Jackson, waded ashore with Giordino and Hogan, and described the situation. At first there was undisguised disbelief, but after seeing their wounds, the bullet-riddled aircraft, and then hearing a deputy sheriff describe the dead and injured FBI agents a few miles downriver, McGean stoked up his boilers, Belcheron rounded up his deck crew, and 40 men from the 6th Louisiana Regiment tramped on board, hooting and hollering and dragging along 2 ancient field cannon. "Put on the coal, boys," McGean pressed his black gang. He looked like the devil with his trimmed goatee and brushed-up eyebrows in the flickering glare of the open furnace doors. "If we mean to save the Vice President, we've got to have more steam!" The Stonewall Jackson thrashed after the towboat and barge, almost as if sensing the urgency of her mission. When new, her top speed was rated at 15 miles an hour. But in the past 40 years, she was never called on to provide more than 12. She thrust downriver with the current at 14, then 15, 16, 18 miles an hour. When she burst from the South Pass Channel, she was driving through the water at 20, smoke and sparks exploding through the flared capitals atop her stacks. The men of the 6th Louisiana Regiment, the dentists, plumbers, accountants who marched and refought battles of the Civil War as a hobby, grunted and sweated in the nondescript woolen gray and butternut uniforms that once clothed the Army of the Confederate States of America. Under the command of a major, they heaved huge cotton bales into place as breastworks. The 2 Napoleon 12-pounder cannon from Fort Jackson were wheeled into position on the bow, their smooth-bore barrels loaded with ball bearings scrounged from McGean's engine room supply locker. Pitt stared down at the growing fortress of wired bales. Cotton against steel, he mused. Single-shot muskets against automatic rifles. It was going to be an interesting fight. Lieutenant Grant tore his eyes from the incredible sight under his wings and radioed the ship flying the British flag. This is Air Force Weather Recon 040, calling Oceanographic Research Vessel. Do you read? Righto, Yank, hear you clearly, came back a cheery voice fresh off a cricket field. This is Her Majesty's ship Pathfinder. What can we do for you, 040? A chopper went into the drink about 3 miles west of you. Can you effect a rescue of survivors, Pathfinder? We bloody well better. Can't allow the poor chaps to drown, can we? I'll circle the crash sector, Pathfinder. Home in on me. Jolly good. We're on our way. Out. Grant took up a position over the struggling men in the water. The Gulf Current was warm, so there was no fear of their succumbing to exposure, but any bleeding wounds were certain to attract sharks.
You don't carry much influence, said his co-pilot. What do you mean? Asked Grant. The limey ship isn't responding. She's turned away.
Grant leaned forward and banked the plane to see out the opposite cockpit window. His co-pilot was right. The Pathfinder's bow had come around on a course away from the helicopter's survivors and was aimed toward the Stonewall Jackson. Pathfinder, this is 040, Grant called. What is your problem? Repeat, what is your problem? There was no reply.
Unless I'm suffering one hell of a hallucination, Metcalf said, staring in wonder at the video transmission. That old relic from Tom Sawyer intends to attack the towboat.
She's giving every indication, Sandecker agreed.
Where do you suppose she came from?
Sandecker stood with his arms crossed in front of him, his face radiating an elated expression.
Pitt, he muttered under his breath, you wily, irrepressible son of a bitch.
You say something?
Just speculating to myself.
What can they possibly hope to accomplish?
I think they mean to ram and board.
Insanity. Sheer insanity, snorted Metcalf gloomily. The gunners on the towboat will cut them to pieces.
Suddenly Sandecker tensed, seeing something in the background on the screen. Metcalf didn't catch it. No one else watching caught it either. The Admiral grasped Metcalf by the arm.
The British vessel!
Metcalf looked up, startled.
What about it?
Good God, man, see for yourself. She's going to run down the steamboat.
Metcalf saw the distance between the two ships rapidly narrowing, saw the wake of the Pathfinder turn to foam as she surged ahead at full speed.
Grant, he bellowed.
Here, sir.
The limey ship, why isn't she headed toward the men in the water?
I can't say, General. Her skipper acknowledged my request for rescue, but chased after the old paddle boat instead. I haven't been able to raise him again. He appears to be ignoring my transmissions.
Take them out, Sandecker demanded. Call in an airstrike and take the bastards out.
Metcalf hesitated, torn by indecision.
But she's flying the British flag, for Christ's sake. I'll stake my rank she's a Bougainville ship and the flag is a decoy.
You can't know that.
Maybe, but I do know that if she crushes the steamboat into firewood, our last chance to save Vince Margolin is gone.